Welcome back to RN Drive. Waleed Ali with you. He's just settled into the last phase of the show for the day, and at least for me, for the week. It's now 1 year since Cyclone Yasi hit parts of North Queensland, and next Tuesday marks 3 years since Australia's worst peacetime disaster, the Black Saturday bushfires in Victoria. 2011 brought the Japanese tsunami, massive floods in Queensland, the Christchurch earthquake. In today's world, 24-hour news coverage really has just given us access and exposure to these events like never before. But behind these devastating random acts of nature are stories from survivors, people and communities who managed to pick up the pieces and rebuild their lives. And that's what we're going to talk about today. As we close the show, joining me to discuss the theme of survival is Celeste Geer, who's the director of Then the Wind Changed, a documentary about the 2009 Victorian bushfires that we'll be screening on the ABC very soon, and Julianne Schultz, editor of this month's Griffith Review, which is a collection of writing from some of Australia's top authors addressing what it means to experience massive tragedy and then to survive. Welcome to RN Drive, both of you.
Good evening. Thanks, Waleed.
Good to, really, really good to have both of you here. I want to start with When the Wind Changed, because this is really an extraordinary documentary, and it's very emotive, and perhaps the best way to explain the way it feels or how it's emotive is just to hear some of it, really. And it was a smorgasbord of things that we could have chosen, but this is a little bit that we cobbled together from it.
I drive home from work, and once I hit this road, I see the burnt trees, and it's not a joyful return to home. It's a return home to Black Saturday. I used to run along this road. How can I run if it feels like I'm running through a cemetery?
Bron and Shane's place was on the ridgeline overlooking Strathewen. They were one of the few families to survive in their street.
Yep, there you go. She's a bit shaky on her feet. Go, Daddy.
I've got fire. I'm nearly catching on fire.
You're okay.
Worry, my son, my surviving son, was able to get a message to me on the phone that Marilyn and Damien, they sheltered in the bathroom. So when I got to the house, I knew where to look. And what I was greeted with was only a very, very small amount of rubble that was in the bath. And I thought, oh, good, they're not in here. But when I kept asking around, had anybody seen them? Nobody had. It was later confirmed that they had perished in the bath.
It's incredibly moving stuff. So that's congratulations on it. Is it difficult?
It was difficult. In fact, you just selected one of the lines there that still gets me, even though I've seen the footage, literally probably 10,000 or more times now.
In the editing suite.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Watched it and re-watched it. But I think it's just so very raw. But I was interested in what you were saying before, Waleed, about the cycle of disasters and how frequently they come and how, because of that 24-hour news cycle, we kind of expect to see these really instantaneous, visceral accounts of the disaster. But because of that, it's a 24-hour cycle, you don't actually see the follow-up. Mm. So that's what I'm kind of most satisfied with about this film, is because we actually get to stay with the people and we get to experience a little bit of that process of recovery with them over the first 2.5 years.
Mm. Now, Julianne, that point of media coverage, you're editing the Griffith Review that's on survival, and that theme of media coverage of natural disaster is picked up in a couple of the pieces in that.
Yeah, there's a quite strong piece by Michael Gawenda, who, in his role at the Centre for Advanced Journalism at the University of Melbourne, did a quite major research project looking at the impact of reporting the bushfires, those 2009 bushfires, with both the journalists who were covering it and also with a bunch of people who were living in the area. It's a sort of useful sort of reflection, and I mean the point he gets to is that the notion of consent is one that's quite difficult in those situations, that people are just in shock by and large, and so they're not well placed to be able to give their active consent to telling their stories. But on the other hand, we need to know what's going on, so it's they're very difficult dilemmas that need to be faced.
Celeste, I should have pointed out, you, of course, yourself are a Strathewen local. This documentary focuses on, these are your people, this is your town.
Mm.
Do you relate to what Julianne's talking about there, or and what Michael Gawenda is writing about, that this, I guess, false or fabricated consent that you feel as a victim in those circumstances talking to media?
Yeah, I read his article, and what I found most interesting was the fact that he commented on, you know, when you go into, and I think it's there's a 48-hour window basically after a disaster when you go in, and you'll get people who are still totally adrenaline-fueled and in shock, and they will be very emotional, probably articulate, but they will give great footage that is dramatic and that the news editors want. But then on reflection, they will kind of think, oh, gee, I feel a bit exposed from that. I think there's also another anthropological principle, which is that traditionally when anthropologists go into a community to try and learn something about it, the person who first presents as the owner of the information and the wise man rarely is. So the wise person, the person who really understands what's going on and actually does have the authority to speak on behalf of the community, he will not be running down the street chasing a cameraman. Yeah. He or she will be reflecting and will be asking what's in it for those people, why do they want this story?
You might just have undone the entire news media industry in one quote.
Well, I mean, as he says in his article, it's a truth that we all exist with. It's a duplicitous role, and I was in a duplicitous role throughout the making of this film because I was both friend and filmmaker to a lot of the people in it, and often those two interests were not compatible.
One of the things that I think is quite striking, and having seen Celeste's film, which is very, very powerful, is that one of the things that these reconstructed documentaries and reconstructed pieces of reportage, such as we've published in this Griffith Review, do is that they make it possible for people to make sense of catastrophes that have occurred and to be able to hold on to them. You were talking before about the anthropology of going into communities and finding out stories. I mean, one of the things that's a point very strongly made in the essay by Professor Tom Griffiths, who's a wonderful historian of fire and ice, essentially. I'm sure many people have seen him on television from Antarctica in recent weeks. But he talks about the sociology of disaster and how people forget. And I think that that comes up, I think, very strongly in Celeste's film as well. I think you film your husband talking about looking for the glimmer of the future to be able to move on and put it behind. But when you see the images in the film, you know, you can't put it behind, you can't forget it because it's so very present.
Absolutely, and that's one of the disconnects, I suppose, when you do experience and you're living in a community that's been impacted so heavily by disaster, is the fact that the outside world move on because there's another disaster, there's something else, and it's natural for them to do that. And if everyone was totally consumed by each disaster, we would all drown in compassion and nothing would ever be achieved. But at the same time, it's quite alienating to see that the longitudinal nature of the stress that people are suffering in that community and the fact that the rest of the world does, you know, have a faster cycle than that.
But it goes further than that. I mean, one of the things that I picked up watching the documentary was that feeling of disconnect, that feeling of being ignored, didn't take long at all. I mean, there was a sense coming from the locals that their needs weren't really understood by other people, that they weren't really getting the help. And it's not like 3 years later they've turned around and said, hang on a second, I mean, this happened pretty quickly.
Well, that was some people were thinking that. I think one of the strengths of Strathewen, which is a community where I'm from that we're talking about, is that we organised very quickly amongst ourselves and formed our own Strathewen Renewal Association. So we kind of really forged the way forward and then told all the government agencies how they could help us. And that was instrumental because I think after a disaster, we're all social creatures and it's like a tone is set. And so in our community, because of this leadership and because of a couple of elders, really, who were often bereaved, often lost their partners and their house, they just had this amazing generosity and ability not to kind of stratify losses and say, you lost a person, you lost a house, but to acknowledge that everyone had lost. And that really set a tone in the community, which kept conflict, you know, to a minimum.
Yeah, sure. And one of the things that's most interesting about it was just seeing the coping mechanisms people came up with, the things that really mattered, which I guess you'd say instinctively, you know, you'd think wouldn't matter. Obviously, the school opening only 4 days later, that's something that you'd think was important. But little things like making toy chickens, like knitting toy chickens together for people, that sort of thing, wasn't just an act, something to do. It really, really mattered. People sowing crops, where they realised it was probably futile to do, but they just needed to do it. They needed the normalcy.
Absolutely. And also, I think in the wake of destruction, it's, you know, it's very natural to have a strong creative urges come from that. I mean, you know, the destruction part of fire is really only one part of that element cycle. The other part is the amazing fertility that it creates and the possibility for new growth.
One of the things that I think is very, very important in Celeste's film is the number of people who talk frankly about the value of seeing psychologists to help them come to terms with what had happened. I think that that's a really important message that, you know, needs to come through and be made very much available, because people, I think, try to cope on their own resources. They try to cope by getting back and being busy and doing things, and often that's beyond you know, an individual's ability to do themselves. And so that legitimizing and making so present the value of getting that external psychological support, I think, is a really important contribution from the documentary.
Thank you. That was actually very important to me, because I was quite shocked, actually, post-disaster. I'm the daughter of a psychologist, so I've never had any stigma in my mind. That's never meant that you're a lunatic if you go and see a psychologist. But I was staggered in this climate how much stigma there still is attached, and how even people who'd suffered amazing loss would still see it as some sort of point of shame to want to go and speak to a professional.
Why?
I just think that there's still a sense of that it, to admit vulnerability is to concede defeat or a weakness or something like that, or they're worried that this person's going to take something from them. I was really blown away by it. But it's interesting that you say that, because at one point I think almost every character in the film was talking about the importance of the psychologist to their recovery, so I actually had to take some of the references out because it was looking like an ad.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, and certainly, the range of catastrophes and disasters that we've got people writing about in this surviving issue of Griffith Review, I mean, goes from the floods in Queensland and the tsunami and the earthquakes in, earthquakes in New Zealand, and, you know, to a whole range of very sort of personal traumas that people have endured. And when one of the things that was sort of interesting when we were putting it together, we thought, I mean, it's some wonderfully strong writing. It's just a very powerful collection. But we were nervous that it would be too down. But what's one of the things which I think is quite interesting is that all the pieces, one way or another, have an arc which ends in some sort of hope. And whether that's a sort of personal engagement, or whether it's, you know, coming up with solutions and talking about ways of building resilience and capacity, every one of those pieces has got that sort of arc. And I think that that's a really important thing to have when you're dealing with these sorts of catastrophes, because it's very easy to slip into a sort of voyeuristic sort of space and not really engage with what really is at stake.
Well, can you survive without that hope? I mean, I just wonder, it seems like it might be a survival mechanism for us.
I think absolutely. I know that I looked in my storytelling for stories that had an element of hope to them, but they weren't that hard to find. That's what I was inspired by throughout the film, was the extraordinary coping mechanisms that very ordinary people are able to call upon in a time of crisis, and their generosity of spirit as well, their ability not to be consumed by their own grief, but to actually empathise with others. And I suppose I'd like to also say that about my film is that I know some people kind of go, oh, I couldn't see anything about the fires, you know, just distressing. It's kind of tragedy porn or something. But it's not, because at the end of the film, most people have been engaged, and I actually think feel a great sense of compassion and connection to other humans, which is, I suppose, what we want.
And there's some fabulous little stories in there as well. Maybe this is just a bit obvious for you to me to latch onto, but the story, the romance emerging between relief workers and locals that were there, that sort of thing that you just wouldn't even think about when you're reading the papers.
Absolutely, yes. And there are thousands and thousands of layers upon layers that aren't in the film that one day I'll write a book.
Oh, come on, give us one.
Well, I was just thinking on the way in, the disaster relief workers, they gave every woman in Strathewen a box of identical lingerie with about 80 items of these quite racy underwear. And because no one had their clothes, they couldn't go back home or they'd lost their home.
Yeah.
We're in this school in this terrible, tragic environment, and you could see around that everyone had matching bra straps sticking out of their dresses.
So, and particularly racy underwear.
Very racy. And we were all laughing.
Did they get the humour of it?
We did. We were like, oh, I've never worn this before in my life, but I have a three-piece matching
Every
suit.
Every cloud has a silver lining.
Well, yeah, you might think so.
I'm interested, Julianne, in Tom Griffith's piece in the Griffith Review, the cycles of disaster that he speaks about, you know, resolve and then blame and then forgetfulness, you know, at the end of that. You've mentioned that you see a bit of that in this film.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, and that sort of, there's extraordinary footage that goes from, you know, that very early shots, and I won't give away the beginning because everyone has to watch it when it's on ABC 2 next week. But
a powerful beginning, though, isn't it?
Very, very powerful beginning. But the scene when Celeste's husband comes back and is walking through the ash, you know, and there's this ash that's just blowing everywhere. It's just, I mean, it's you can feel it. But then it's not long, and all of a sudden, you know, the fields are covered with green. And there's green coming through the trees and so on. I mean, that process of renewal and growth, I mean, it is quite extraordinary. And it's one of the things that Tom writes about in his piece from another community where there were a lot of artists in the I think it's called Slacks River, was a lot of artists there. And they found that they were finding ways to express what was going on. And one of the women, if I can find it quickly, I'll quote it. She said that she'd, you know, she'd never painted in black. And then immediately after the fire, she was painting. She found she was using black paint all the time. And then before too long, she got to the point where she said by the following year, her palette had exploded into wild, joyous profusion. And she said, this is what I see now, like a filigree, these gorgeous colours, the orange of the moss, I've burst into colour. And so it's that sort of amazing process over a couple of years. Sorry, Steeles Creek is the name of the town. And that sort of the creativity and the attempt to come to terms with what's occurred and make some sort of sense of it, but to also engage with this renewal and the life that can come out of it.
It is productive. Look, the great images that you painted in our head there, Julianne, and they're good images on which we really have to leave this, unfortunately. I'm sad to say that. That's the February edition of the Griffith Review. Julianne Schultz is the editor. Thank you for joining us, Julianne. And Celeste Gear, a Strathewen local and a director of Then the Wind Changed. Thursday, the 7th of February at 8:30. Tuesday, the 7th of February, 8:30 p.m. on ABC 2.